has to produce the intelligent conclusions. The theorist is forbidden to peer inside and read the symbols, make sense of them, and poke around to nudge the device in smart directions like some deus ex machina. Now we are in a position to pose the Whorfian question in a precise way. Remember that a representation does not have to look like English or any other language. It just has to use symbols to represent concepts, and arrangements of symbols to represent the logical relations among them, according to some consistent scheme. But though internal representations in an English speaker's mind don't have to look like English, they could, in principle, look like English, or like whatever language the person happens to speak. So here is the question. Do they, in fact? For example, if we know that Socrates is a man, is it because we have neural patterns that correspond one-to-one to the English words Socrates, is, a, and man, and groups of neurons in the brain that correspond to the subject of an English sentence, the verb and the object, laid out in that order? Or do we use some other code for representing concepts and their relations in our heads, a language of thought or mentalese that is not the same as any of the world's languages? We can answer this question by seeing whether English sentences embody the information that a processor would need to perform valid sequences of reasoning, without requiring any fully intelligent homunculus inside doing the understanding. The answer is a clear no. English, or any other language people speak, is hopelessly unsuited to serve as our internal medium of computation. Consider some of the problems. The first is ambiguity. These headlines actually appeared in newspapers. Child's stool, great for use in garden. Stud tires out. Stiff opposition expected to casketless funeral plan. Drunk gets 9 months in violin case. Iraqi head seeks arms. Queen Mary having bottom scraped. Columnist gets urologist in trouble with his peers. Each headline contains a word that is ambiguous, but surely the thought underlying the word is not ambiguous. The writers of the headlines surely knew which of the two senses of the words stool, stud, and stiff they themselves had in mind. And if there can be two thoughts corresponding to one word, thoughts can't be words. The second problem with English is its lack of logical explicitness. Consider the following example, devised by the computer scientist Drew McDermott. Ralph is an elephant. Elephants live in Africa. Elephants have tusks. Our inference-making device, with some minor modifications to handle the English grammar of the sentences, would deduce Ralph lives in Africa and Ralph has tusks. This sounds fine, but isn't. Intelligent you, the listener, knows that the Africa that Ralph lives in is the same Africa that all the other elephants live in, but that Ralph's tusks are his own. But the symbol copier creeper sensor that is supposed to be a model of you doesn't know that, because the distinction is nowhere to be found in any of the statements. If you object that this is just common sense, you would be right, but it's common sense that we're trying to account for, and English sentences do not embody the information that a processor needs to carry out common sense. A third problem is called coreference. Say you start talking about an individual by referring to him as the tall blonde man with one black shoe. The second time you refer to him in the conversation, you are likely to call him the man. The third time, just him. But the three expressions do not refer to three people, or even to three ways of thinking about a single person. The second and third are just ways of saving breath. Something in the brain must treat them as the same thing. English isn't doing it. A fourth related problem comes from those aspects of language that can only be interpreted in the context of a conversation or text, what linguists call deixis. Consider articles like a and the. What is the difference between killed a policeman and killed the policeman? Only that in the second sentence, it is assumed that some specific policeman was mentioned earlier, or is salient in the context. Thus, in isolation, the two phrases are synonymous, but in the following contexts, the first from an actual newspaper article, their meanings are completely different. A policeman's 14-year-old son, apparently enraged after being disciplined for a bad grade, opened fire from his house, killing a policeman and wounding three people before he was shot dead. A policeman's 14-year-old son, apparently enraged after being disciplined for a bad grade, opened fire from his house, killing the policeman and wounding three people before he was shot dead. Outside of a particular conversation or text, then, the words a and the are quite meaningless. They have no place in one's permanent mental database. Other conversation-specific words like here, there, this, that, now, then, I, me, my, her, we, and you pose the same problems, as the following old joke illustrates. First guy. I didn't sleep with my wife before we were married. Did you? Second guy. I don't know. What was her maiden name? A fifth problem is synonymy. The sentences, Sam sprayed paint onto the wall. Sam sprayed the wall with paint. Paint was sprayed onto the wall by Sam. The wall was sprayed with paint by Sam. Refer to the same event and therefore license many of the same inferences. For example, in all four cases, one may conclude that the wall has paint on it. But there are four distinct arrangements of words. You know that they mean the same thing, but no simple processor crawling over them as Marx would know that. Something else that is not one of those arrangements of words must be representing the single event that you know is common to all four. For example, the event might be represented as something like this. Sam spray can. Cause. Paint go to. On wall. Which, assuming we don't take the English words seriously, is not too far from one of the leading proposals about what mentalese looks like. These examples, and there are many more, illustrate a single important point. The representations underlying thinking, on the one hand, and the sentences in a language, on the other, are in many ways at cross purposes. Any particular thought in our head embraces a vast amount of information. But when it comes to communicating a thought to someone else, attention spans are short and mouths are slow. To get information into a listener's head in a reasonable amount of time, a speaker can encode only a fraction of the message into words and must count on the listener to fill in the rest. But inside a single head, the demands are different. Airtime is not a limited resource. Different parts of the brain are connected to one another directly with thick cables that can transfer huge amounts of information quickly. Nothing can be left to the imagination, though, because the internal representations are the imagination. We end up with the following picture. People do not think in English or Chinese or Apache. They think in a language of thought. This language of thought probably looks a bit like all these languages. Presumably it has symbols for concepts and arrangements of symbols that correspond to who did what to whom, as in the paint-spraying representation mentioned earlier. But compared with any given language, mentalese must be richer in some ways and simpler in others. It must be richer, for example, in that several concept symbols must correspond to a given English word like stool or stud. There must be extra paraphernalia that differentiate logically distinct kinds of concepts, like Ralph's tusks versus tusks in general, and that link different symbols that refer to the same thing, like the tall blonde man with one black shoe and the man. On the other hand, Mentalese must be simpler than spoken languages. Conversation-specific words and constructions like "ah" and "the" are absent, and information about pronouncing words or even ordering them is unnecessary. Now, it could be that English speakers think in some kind of simplified and annotated quasi-English, with the design I have just described, and that Apache speakers think in a simplified and annotated quasi-Apache. But to get these languages of thought to subserve reasoning properly, they would have to look much more like each other than either one does to its spoken counterpart, and it is likely that they are the same. A universal Mentalese. Knowing a language, then, is knowing how to translate Mentalese into strings of words and vice versa. People without a language would still have Mentalese, and babies and many non-human animals presumably have simpler dialects. Indeed, if babies did not have a Mentalese to translate to and from English, it is not clear how learning English could take place, or even what learning English would mean. So where does all this leave Newspeak? Here are my predictions for the year 2050. First, since mental life goes on independently of particular languages, concepts of freedom and equality will be thinkable even if they are nameless. Second, since there are far more concepts than there are words, and listeners must always charitably fill in what the speaker leaves unsaid, existing words will quickly gain new senses, perhaps even regain their original senses. Third, since children are not content to reproduce any old input from adults, but create a complex grammar that can go beyond it, they would creolize Newspeak into a natural language, possibly in a single generation. The 21st century toddler may be Winston Smith's revenge. Chapter 4. How Language Works. Journalists say that when a dog bites a man, that is not news. But when a man bites a dog, that is news. This is the essence of the language instinct. Language conveys news. The streams of words called sentences are not just memory prods, reminding you of man and man's best friend and letting you fill in the rest. They tell you who in fact did what to whom. Thus, we get more from most stretches of language than Woody Allen got from War and Peace, which he read in 2 hours after taking speed reading lessons. It was about some Russians. Language allows us to know how octopuses make love and how to remove cherry stains and why Tad was heartbroken and whether the Red Sox will win the World Series without a good relief pitcher and how to build an atom bomb in your basement and how Catherine the Great died, among other things. When scientists see some apparent magic trick in nature, like bats homing in on insects in pitch blackness, or salmon returning to breed in their natal stream, they look for the engineering principles behind it. For bats, the trick turned out to be sonar. For salmon, it was locking into a faint scent trail. What is the trick behind the ability of Homo sapiens to convey that man bites dog? In fact, there is not one trick, but two, and they are associated with the names of two European scholars who wrote in the 19th century. The first principle, articulated by the Swiss linguist Ferdinand de Saussure, is the arbitrariness of the sign, the wholly conventional pairing of a sound with a meaning. The word dog does not look like a dog, walk like a dog, or woof like a dog, but it means dog just the same. It does so because every English speaker has undergone an identical act of rote learning in childhood that links the sound to the meaning. For the price of this standardized memorization, the members of a language community receive an enormous benefit, the ability to convey a concept from mind to mind virtually instantaneously. Sometimes the gunshot marriage between sound and meaning can be amusing. As Richard Lederer points out in Crazy English, we drive on a parkway, but park in a driveway. There is no ham in hamburger, or bread and sweet breads, and blueberries are blue, but cranberries are not cran. But think about the sane alternative of depicting a concept so that receivers can apprehend the meaning in the form. The process is so challenging to the ingenuity, so comically unreliable, that we have made it into party games like Pictionary and charades. The second trick behind the language instinct is captured in a phrase from Wilhelm von Humboldt that presaged Chomsky. Language makes infinite use of finite media. We know the differences between the forgettable dog bites man and the newsworthy man bites dog because of the order in which dog, man, and bites are combined. That is, we use a code to translate between orders of words and combinations of thoughts. That code or set of rules is called a generative grammar. As I have mentioned, it should not be confused with the pedagogical and stylistic grammars we encountered in school. The principle underlying grammar is unusual in the natural world. A grammar is an example of a discrete combinatorial system. A finite number of discrete elements, in this case words, are sampled, combined, and permuted to create larger structures, in this case sentences, with properties that are quite distinct from those of their elements. For example, the meaning of man bites dog is different from the meaning of any of the three words inside it, and different from the meaning of the same words combined in the reverse order. In a discrete combinatorial system like language, there can be an unlimited number of completely distinct combinations with an infinite range of properties. Another noteworthy discrete combinatorial system in the natural world is the genetic code in DNA, where four kinds of nucleotides are combined into 64 kinds of codons, and the codons can be strung into an unlimited number of different genes. Many biologists have capitalized on the close parallel between the principles of grammatical combination and the principles of genetic combination. In the technical language of genetics, sequences of DNA are said to contain letters and punctuation, maybe palindromic, meaningless or synonymous, are transcribed and translated, and are even stored in libraries. The immunologist Niels Jerner entitled his Nobel Prize address, "The Generative Grammar of the Immune System." Most of the complicated systems we see in the world, in contrast, are blending systems, like geology, paint mixing, cooking, sound, light, and weather. In a blending system, the properties of the combination lie between the properties of its elements, and the properties of the elements are lost in the average or mixture. For example, combining red paint and white paint results in pink paint. Thus, the range of properties that can be found in a blending system are highly circumscribed, and the only way to differentiate large numbers of combinations is to discriminate tinier and tinier differences. It may not be a coincidence that the two systems in the universe that most impress us with their open-ended complex design, life and mind, are based on discrete combinatorial systems. Many biologists believe that if inheritance were not discrete, evolution as we know it could not have taken place. The way language works, then, is that each person's brain contains a lexicon of words and the concepts they stand for, a mental dictionary, and a set of rules that combine the words to convey relationships among concepts, a mental grammar. We will explore the world of words in the next chapter. This one is devoted to the design of grammar. The fact that grammar is a discrete combinatorial system has two important consequences. The first is the sheer vastness of language. Go to the Library of Congress and pick a sentence at random from any volume, and chances are you would fail to find an exact repetition, no matter how long you continued to search. Estimates of the number of sentences that an ordinary person is capable of producing are breathtaking. If a speaker is interrupted at a random point in a sentence, there are, on average, about 10 different words that could be inserted at that point to continue the sentence in a grammatical and meaningful way. At some points in a sentence, only one word can be inserted, and at others, there is a choice from among thousands. 10 is the average. Let's assume that a person is capable of producing sentences up to 20 words long. Therefore, the number of sentences that a speaker can deal with in principle is at least 10 to the 20th power, a 1 with 20 zeros after it, or 100 million trillion. At a rate of 5 seconds a sentence, a person would need a childhood of about 100 trillion years, with no time for eating or sleeping, to memorize them all. In fact, the 20-word limitation is far too severe. The following comprehensible sentence from George Bernard Shaw, for example, is 110 words long. Stranger still, though Jacques Dalcroze, like all these great teachers, is the completest of tyrants, knowing what is right and that he must and will have the lesson just so, or else break his heart. Not somebody else's, observe. Yet his school is so fascinating that every woman who sees it exclaims, "Oh, why was I not taught like this?" And elderly gentlemen excitedly enroll themselves as students and distract classes of infants by their desperate endeavors to beat two in a bar with one hand and three with the other, and start off on earnest walks around the room, taking two steps backward whenever Monsieur Dalcroze calls out, "Hop." Indeed, if you put aside the fact that the days of our age are 80, each of us is capable of uttering an infinite number of different sentences. By the same logic that shows that there are an infinite number of integers, if you ever think you have the largest integer, just add one to it, and you will have another. There must be an infinite number of sentences. The Guinness Book of World Records once claimed to recognize the longest English sentence, a 1,300-word stretch in William Faulkner's novel Absalom, Absalom, that begins, "They both bore it as though in deliberate, flagellant exaltation." I am tempted to achieve immortality by submitting the following record-breaker. Faulkner wrote, "They both bore it as though in deliberate, flagellant exaltation." But it would be only the proverbial 15 minutes of fame, for soon I could be bested by. Pinker wrote that Faulkner wrote, "They both bore it as though in deliberate, flagellant exaltation." And that record too would fall when someone submitted, "Who cares that Pinker wrote that Faulkner wrote? They both bore it as though in deliberate, flagellant exaltation." And so on, ad infinitum. The infinite use of finite media distinguishes the human brain from virtually all the artificial language devices we commonly come across, like pull-string dolls, cars that nag you to close the door, and cheery voicemail instructions. Press the pound key for more options, all of which use a fixed list of prefabricated sentences. The second consequence of the design of grammar is that it is a code that is autonomous from cognition. A grammar specifies how words may combine to express meanings. That specification is independent of the particular meanings we typically convey or expect others to convey to us. Thus, we all sense that some strings of words that can be given common sense interpretations do not conform to the grammatical code of English. Here are some strings that we can easily interpret, but that we sense are not properly formed. Welcome to Chinese restaurant. Please try your nice Chinese food with chopsticks, the traditional and typical of Chinese glorious history and cultural. It's a flying finches, they are. The child seems sleeping. Is raining. Sally poured the glass with water. Who did a book about impress you? Skid crash hospital. Drum vapor, worker cigarette flick, boom. This sentence no verb. This sentence has contains two verbs. This sentence has cabbage 6 words. This is not a complete. This either. These sentences are ungrammatical. not in the sense of split infinitives, dangling participles, and the other hobgoblins of the school marm, but in the sense that every ordinary speaker of the casual vernacular has a gut feeling that something is wrong with them, despite their interpretability. Ungrammaticality is simply a consequence of our having a fixed code for interpreting sentences. For some strings, a meaning can be guessed, but we lack confidence that the speaker has used the same code in producing the sentence as we used in interpreting it. For similar reasons, computers, which are less forgiving of ungrammatical input than human listeners, express their displeasure in all too familiar dialogues like this one. Greater than print, parenthesis x plus 1. 5 asterisks, syntax error, 5 asterisks. The opposite can happen as well. Sentences can make no sense, but can still be recognized as grammatical. The classic example is a sentence from Chomsky, his only entry in Bartlett's familiar quotations. Colorless green ideas sleep furiously. The sentence was contrived to show that syntax and sense can be independent of each other, but the point was made long before Chomsky. The genre of nonsense verse and prose, popular in the 19th century, depends on it. Here is an example from Edward Lear, the acknowledged master of nonsense. It's a fact the whole world knows, that pobbles are happier without their toes. Mark Twain once parodied the romantic description of nature written more for its mellifluousness than its content. It was a crisp and spicy morning in early October. The lilacs and laburnums, lit with the glory fires of autumn, hung burning and flashing in the upper air. A fairy bridge provided by kind nature for the wingless wild things that have their homes in the treetops and would visit together. The larch and the pomegranate flung their purple and yellow flames in brilliant, broad splashes along the slanting sweep of the woodland. The sensuous fragrance of innumerable deciduous flowers rose upon the swooning atmosphere. Far in the empty sky, a solitary esophagus slept upon motionless wing. Everywhere brooded stillness, serenity, and the peace of God. And almost everyone knows the poem in Lewis Carroll's Through the Looking Glass that ends, "And as in uffish thought he stood, the Jabberwock with eyes of flame came whiffling through the tulgey wood, and burbled as it came. 1, 2, 1, 2, and through the vorpal blade went snickersnack. He left it dead, and with its head he went galumphing back. 'And hast thou slain the Jabberwock? Come to my arms, my beamish boy. O frabjous day, Callooh Callay!'" he chortled in his joy. 'Twas brillig, and the slithy toves did gyre and gimble in the wabe. All mimsy were the borogoves, and the mome raths outgrabe. As Alice said, "Somehow it seems to fill my head with ideas, only I don't exactly know what they are." But though common sense and common knowledge are of no help in understanding these passages, English speakers recognize that they are grammatical, and their mental rules allow them to extract precise, though abstract, frameworks of meaning. Alice deduced, "Somebody killed something. That's clear, at any rate." And after reading Chomsky's entry in Bartlett's, anyone can answer questions like, "What slept? How? Did one thing sleep or several? What kind of ideas were they?" How might the combinatorial grammar underlying human language work? The most straightforward way to combine words in order is explained in Michael Frayn's novel, The Tin Men. The protagonist, Goldwasser, is an engineer working at an institute for automation. He must devise a computer system that generates the standard kinds of stories found in the daily papers, like "Paralyzed Girl Determined to Dance Again." Here he is, hand-testing a program that composes stories about royal occasions. He opened the filing cabinet and picked out the first card in the set. Traditionally, it read. Now there was a random choice between cards reading coronations, engagements, funerals, weddings, comings of age, births, deaths, or the churching of women. The day before he had picked funerals and had been directed on to a card reading with simple perfection, "Are occasions for mourning." Today he closed his eyes, drew weddings, and was signposted on "To are occasions for rejoicing." The wedding of X and Y followed in logical sequence and brought him a choice between "is no exception" and "is a case in point." Either way, there followed "indeed." Indeed, whichever occasion one had started off with, whether coronations, deaths, or births, Goldwasser saw with intense mathematical pleasure. One now reached this same elegant bottleneck. He paused on "indeed," then drew in quick succession, "it is a particularly happy occasion, rarely," and "can there have been a more popular young couple?" From the next selection, Goldwasser drew, "X has won himself, herself, a special place in the nation's affections," which forced him to go on to, "and the British people have cleverly taken Y to their hearts already." Goldwasser was surprised and a little disturbed to realize that the word "fitting" had still not come up. But he drew it with the next card. "It is especially fitting that..." This gave him, "the bride, bridegroom should be," and an open choice between, "of such a noble and illustrious line, a commoner in these democratic times, from a nation with which this country has long enjoyed a particularly close and cordial relationship, and from a nation with which this country's relations have not in the past been always happy." Feeling that he had done particularly well with "fitting" last time, Goldwasser now deliberately selected it again. "It is also fitting that," read the card, to be quickly followed by, "we should remember, and X and Y are not mere symbols. They are a lively young man, and a very lovely young woman." Goldwasser shut his eyes to draw the next card. It turned out to read, "In these days when..." He pondered whether to select, "It is fashionable to scoff at the traditional morality of marriage and family life," or, "It is no longer fashionable to scoff at the traditional morality of marriage and family life." The latter had more of the form's authentic Baroque splendor, he decided. Let's call this a word chain device. The technical name is a finite state or Markov model. A word chain device is a bunch of lists of words, or prefabricated phrases, and the set of directors for going from list to list. A processor builds a sentence by selecting a word from one list, then a word from another list, and so on. To recognize a sentence spoken by another person, one just checks the words against each list in order. Word chain systems are commonly used in satires like Frayn's, usually as do-it-yourself recipes for composing examples of a kind of verbiage. For example, here is a social science jargon generator, which the reader may operate by picking a word at random from the first column, dialectical, defunctionalized, positivistic, predicative, multilateral, quantitative, divergent, synchronous, differentiated, inductive, integrated, distributive. Then a word from the second, participatory, degenerative, aggregating, appropriative, simulated, homogeneous, transfigurative, diversifying, cooperative, progressive, complementary, eliminative. Then one from the third, interdependence, diffusion, periodicity, synthesis, sufficiency, equivalence, expectancy, plasticity, epigenesis, constructivism, deformation, solidification. and stringing them together to form an impressive-sounding term like inductive aggregating interdependence. Recently, I saw a word chain device that generates breathless book jacket blurbs and another for Bob Dylan's song lyrics. A word chain device is the simplest example of a discrete combinatorial system, since it is capable of creating an unlimited number of distinct combinations from a finite set of elements. Parodies notwithstanding, a word chain device can generate infinite sets of grammatical English sentences. For example, the extremely simple scheme, the, a, one, happy, boy, girl, dog, eats, ice cream, hot dogs, candy, assembles many sentences, such as, a girl eats ice cream, and the happy dog eats candy. It can assemble an infinite number, because the word happy can be repeated any number of times. The happy dog eats ice cream. The happy, happy dog eats ice cream. And so on. When an engineer has to build a system to combine words in particular orders, a word chain device is the first thing that comes to mind. The recorded voice that gives you a phone number when you dial directory assistance is a good example. A human speaker is recorded uttering the 10 digits, each in 7 different sing-song patterns. One for the first position in a phone number, one for the second position, and so on. With just these 70 recordings, 10 million phone numbers can be assembled. With another 30 recordings for 3-digit area codes, 10 billion numbers are possible. In practice, many are never used because of restrictions like the absence of 0 and 1 from the beginning of a phone number. In fact, there have been serious efforts to model the English language as a very large word chain. To make it as realistic as possible, the transitions from one word list to another can reflect the actual probabilities that those kinds of words follow one another in English. For example, the word that is much more likely to be followed by is than by indicates. Huge databases of these transition probabilities have been compiled by having a computer analyze bodies of English text or by asking volunteers to name the words that first come to mind after a given word or series of words. Some psychologists have suggested that human language is based on a huge word chain stored in the brain. The idea is congenial to stimulus response theories. A stimulus elicits a spoken word as a response, then the speaker perceives his or her own response, which serves as the next stimulus, eliciting one out of several words as the next response, and so on. But the fact that word chain devices seem ready-made for parodies like Frayn's raises suspicions. The point of the various parodies is that the genre being satirized is so mindless and cliché-ridden that a simple mechanical method can churn out an unlimited number of examples that can almost pass for the real thing. The humor works because of the discrepancy between the two. We all assume that people, even sociologists and reporters, are not really word chain devices. They only seem that way. The modern study of grammar began when Chomsky showed that word chain devices are not just a bit suspicious. They are deeply, fundamentally, the wrong way to think about how human language works. They are discrete combinatorial systems, but they are the wrong kind. There are three problems, and each one illuminates some aspect of how language really does work. First, a sentence of English is a completely different thing from a string of words chained together according to the transition probabilities of English. Remember Chomsky's sentence, "Colorless green ideas sleep furiously"? He contrived it not only to show that nonsense can be grammatical, but also to show that improbable word sequences can be grammatical. In English texts, the probability that the word colorless is followed by the word green is surely zero. So is the probability that green is followed by ideas, ideas by sleep, and sleep by furiously. Nonetheless, the string is a well-formed sentence of English. Conversely, when one actually assembles word chains using probability tables, the resulting word strings are very far from being well-formed sentences. For example, say you take estimates of the set of words most likely to come after every four-word sequence and use those estimates to grow a string word by word, always looking at the four most recent words to determine the next one. The string will be eerily Englishy, but not English. Like, house to ask for is to earn out living by working towards a goal for his team in old New York was a wonderful place, wasn't it? Even pleasant to talk about and laugh hard when he tells lies he should not tell me, the reason why you are is evident. The discrepancy between English sentences and Englishy word chains has two lessons. When people learn a language, they are learning how to put words in order, but not by recording which word follows which other word. They do it by recording which word category, noun, verb, and so on, follows which other category. That is, we can recognize colorless green ideas because it has the same order of adjectives and nouns that we learned from more familiar sequences like strapless black dresses. The second lesson is that the nouns and verbs and adjectives are not just hitched end to end in one long chain. There is some overarching blueprint or plan for the sentence that puts each word in a specific slot. If a word chain device is designed with sufficient cleverness, it can deal with these problems. But Chomsky had a definitive refutation of the very idea that a human language is a word chain. He proved that certain sets of English sentences could not, even in principle, be produced by a word chain device, no matter how big or how faithful to probability tables the device is. Consider sentences like the following. Either the girl eats ice cream, or the girl eats candy. If the girl eats ice cream, then the boy eats hot dogs. At first glance, it seems easy to accommodate these sentences. But the device does not work. Either must be followed later in a sentence by or. No one says, either the girl eats ice cream, then the girl eats candy. Similarly, if requires then. No one says, if the girl eats ice cream or the girl likes candy. But to satisfy the desire of a word early in a sentence for some other word late in the sentence, the device has to remember the early word while it is churning out all the words in between. And that is the problem. A word chain device is an amnesiac, remembering only which word list it is just chosen from, nothing earlier. By the time it reaches the or-then list, it has no means of remembering whether it said if or either way back at the beginning. From our vantage point, peering down at the entire roadmap, we can remember which choice the device made at the first fork in the road, but the device itself, creeping ant-like from list to list, has no way of remembering. Now, you might think it would be a simple matter to redesign the device so that it does not have to remember early choices at late points in the sentence. For example, one could join up either and or and all the possible word sequences in between into one giant sequence, and if and then, and all the sequences in between, as a second giant sequence, before returning to a third copy of the sequence, yielding a chain so long I have to print it sideways. There is something immediately disturbing about this solution. There are three identical subnetworks. Clearly, whatever people can say between an either and an or, they can say between an if and a then, and also after the or the then. But this ability should come naturally out of the design of whatever the device is in people's heads that allows them to speak. It shouldn't depend on the designers carefully writing down three identical sets of instructions, or more plausibly, on the child's having to learn the structure of the English sentence three different times, once between if and then, once between either and or, and once after a then or an or. But Chomsky showed that the problem is even deeper. Each of these sentences can be embedded in any of the others, including itself. If either the girl eats ice cream or the girl eats candy, then the boy eats hot dogs. Either if the girl eats ice cream, then the boy eats ice cream, or if the girl eats ice cream, then the boy eats candy. For the first sentence, the device has to remember if and either, so that it can continue later with or and then in that order. For the second sentence, it has to remember either and if, so that it can complete the sentence with then and or, and so on. Since there's no limit in principle to the number of ifs and eithers that can begin a sentence, each requiring its own order of thens and ors to complete it, it does no good to spell out each memory sequence as its own chain of lists. You'd need an infinite number of chains, which won't fit inside a finite brain. This argument may strike you as scholastic. No real person ever begins a sentence with either, either, if, either, if. So who cares whether a putative model of that person can complete it with then, or. But Chomsky was just adopting the aesthetic of the mathematician, using the interaction between either or and if then as the simplest possible example of a property of language. Its use of long-distance dependencies between an early word and a later one to prove mathematically that word chain devices cannot handle these dependencies. The dependencies, in fact, abound in languages, and mere mortals use them all the time, over long distances, often handling several at once, just what a word chain device cannot do. For example, there is an old grammarian's saw about how a sentence can end in five prepositions. Daddy trudges upstairs to Junior's bedroom to read him a bedtime story. Junior spots the book, scowls, and asks, "Daddy, what did you bring that book that I don't want to be read to out of up for?" By the point at which he utters "read," Junior has committed himself to holding four dependencies in mind. To be read demands two. That book that requires out of. Bring requires up, and what requires for. An even better real-life example comes from a letter to TV Guide. How Anne Salisbury can claim that Pam Dauber's anger at not receiving her fair share of acclaim for Mork and Mindy's success derives from a fragile ego escapes me. At the point just after the word not, the letter writer had to keep four grammatical commitments in mind. Not requires ing, her anger at not receiving acclaim. Two, at requires some kind of noun or gerund, her anger at not receiving acclaim. Three, the singular subject, Pam Dauber's anger, requires the verb 14 words downstream to agree with it in number. Dauber's anger derives from. Four, the singular subject beginning with how requires the verb 27 words downstream to agree with it in number. How escapes me. Similarly, a reader must keep these dependencies in mind while interpreting the sentence. Now, technically speaking, one could rig up a word chain model to handle even these sentences as long as there is some actual limit on the number of dependencies that the speaker need keep in mind. Four, say. But the degree of redundancy in the device would be absurd. For each of the thousands of combinations of dependencies, an identical chain must be duplicated inside the device. In trying to fit such a superchain in a person's memory, one quickly runs out of brain. The difference between the artificial combinatorial system we see in word chain devices and the natural one we see in the human brain is summed up in a line from the Joyce Kilmer poem, "Only God can make a tree." A sentence is not a chain, but a tree. In a human grammar, words are grouped into phrases, like twigs joined in a branch. The phrase is given a name, a mental symbol, and little phrases can be joined into bigger ones. Take the sentence, The happy boy eats ice cream. It begins with three words that hang together as a unit. The noun phrase, the happy boy. In English, a noun phrase, NP, is composed of a noun, N, sometimes preceded by an article or determinator, abbreviated det, and any number of adjectives, A. All this can be captured in a rule that defines what English noun phrases look like in general. A noun phrase consists of an optional determiner, followed by any number of adjectives, followed by a noun. Here are two other rules, one defining the English sentence, S, the other defining the predicate or verb phrase, VP. Both use the NP symbol as an ingredient. S consists of NP, VP. A sentence consists of a noun phrase followed by a verb phrase. VP consists of V, NP. A verb phrase consists of a verb followed by a noun phrase. We now need a mental dictionary that specifies which words belong to which part of speech categories, noun, verb, adjective, preposition, determiner. N consists of boy, girl, dog, cat, ice cream, candy, hot dogs. Nouns may be drawn from the following list, boy, girl, etc. V consists of eats, likes, bites. Verbs may be drawn from the following list, eats, likes, bites. A consists of happy, lucky, tall. Adjectives may be drawn from the following list, happy, lucky, tall. Determiner consists of a, the, one. Determiners may be drawn from the following list, a, the, one. The invisible superstructure holding the words in place is a powerful invention that eliminates the problems of word chain devices. The key insight is that a tree is modular, like telephone jacks or garden hose couplers. A symbol like NP is like a connector or fitting of a certain shape. It allows one component, a phrase, to snap into any of several positions inside other components, larger phrases. Once a kind of phrase is defined by a rule and given its connector symbol, it never has to be defined again. The phrase can be plugged in anywhere there is a corresponding socket. For example, in the little grammar I have listed, the symbol NP is used both as the subject of a sentence, S consists of NP, VP, and as the object of a verb phrase, VP consists of V, NP. In a more realistic grammar, it would also be used as the object of a preposition, near the boy, in a possessor phrase, the boy's bat, as an indirect object, give the boy a cookie, and in several other positions. This plug-and-socket arrangement explains how people can use the same kind of phrase in many different positions in a sentence, including the happy, happy boy eats ice cream. I like the happy, happy boy. I gave the happy, happy boy a cookie. The happy, happy boy's cat eats ice cream. There is no need to learn that the adjective precedes the noun, rather than vice versa, for the subject, and then have to learn the same thing for the object, and again for the indirect object, and yet again for the possessor. Note, too, that the promiscuous coupling of any phrase with any slot makes grammar autonomous from our common-sense expectations involving the meanings of the words. It thus explains why we can write and appreciate grammatical nonsense. Our little grammar defines all kinds of colorless green sentences, like, the happy, happy candy likes the tall ice cream, as well as conveying such newsworthy events as, the girl bites the dog. Most interestingly, the labeled branches of a phrase structure tree act as an overarching memory or plan for the whole sentence. This allows nested long-distance dependencies like if, then, and either, or to be handled with ease, All you need is a rule defining a phrase that contains a copy of the very same kind of phrase, such as, S consists of either S or S. A sentence can consist of the word either, followed by a sentence followed by the word or, followed by another sentence. S consists of if S, then S. A sentence can consist of the word if, followed by a sentence, followed by the word then, followed by another sentence. These rules embed one instance of a symbol inside another instance of the same symbol. Here, a sentence inside a sentence. A neat trick. Logicians call it recursion, for generating an infinite number of structures. The pieces of the bigger sentence are held together in order as a set of branches growing out of a common node. That node holds together each either with its or, each if with its then. If either the girl eats ice cream or the girl eats candy, then the boy eats hot dogs. There is another reason to believe that a sentence is held together by a mental tree. So far, I have been talking about stringing words into a grammatical order, ignoring what they mean. But grouping words into phrases is also necessary to connect grammatical sentences with their proper meanings, chunks of metallese. We know that that sentence is about a girl, not a boy, eating ice cream, and a boy, not a girl, eating hot dogs. And we know that the boy's snack is contingent on the girl's, not vice versa. That is because girl and ice cream are connected inside their own phrase, as are boy and hot dogs, as are the two sentences involving the girl. With a chaining device, it's just one damn word after another, but with a phrase structure grammar, the connectedness of words in the tree reflects the relatedness of ideas in mentalese. Phrase structure, then, is one solution to the engineering problem of taking an interconnected web of thoughts in the mind and encoding them as a string of words that must be uttered, one at a time, by the mouth. One way to see how invisible phrase structure determines meaning is to recall one of the reasons mentioned in Chapter 3 that language and thought have to be different. A particular stretch of language can correspond to two distinct thoughts. I showed you examples like child's stool is great for use in garden, where the single word stool has two meanings corresponding to two entries in the mental dictionary. But sometimes a whole sentence has two meanings, even if each individual word has only one meaning. In the movie Animal Crackers, Groucho Marx says, "I once shot an elephant in my pajamas. How he got into my pajamas, I'll never know." Here are some similar ambiguities that accidentally appeared in newspapers. Yoko Ono will talk about her husband, John Lennon, who was killed in an interview with Barbara Walters. Two cars were reported stolen by the Groveton police yesterday. The license fee for altered dogs with a certificate will be $3, and for pets owned by senior citizens who have not been altered, the fee will be $1.50. Tonight's program discusses stress, exercise, nutrition, and sex with Celtic forward Scott Wedman, Dr. Ruth Westheimer, and Dick Cavett. We will sell gasoline to anyone in a glass container. For sale, mixing bowl set designed to please a cook with round bottom for efficient beating. The two meanings in each sentence come from the different ways in which the words can be joined up in a tree. For example, in Discuss Sex with Dick Cavett, the writer put the words together according to the tree that says PP means prepositional phrase. Sex is what is to be discussed, and it is to be discussed with Dick Cavett. The alternative meaning comes from our analyzing the words sex with Dick Cavett, and sex with Dick Cavett is what is to be discussed. Phrase structure, clearly, is the kind of stuff language is made of. But what I have shown you is just a toy. In the rest of this chapter, I will try to explain the modern Chomskyan theory of how language works. Chomsky's writing are classics, in Mark Twain's sense, something that everybody wants to have read and nobody wants to read. When I come across one of the countless popular books on mind, language, and human nature that referred to Chomsky's deep structure